Ever since Beef Wellington became a murder weapon, I've been wondering, what's up with mushrooms? Hello, Anne Jones here from What the Duck, and I'm trying to work out why would fungi be so poisonous that it can kill you? And death caps in particular, why are you so apparently delicious? What do you want, to be eaten or not? To find out, search for What the Duck and look for mushrooms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
From Ngunnawal country in Canberra and acknowledging other custodians, I'm Lexi Junawick filling in for Luke Sidham-Dundon. And today on The Breakfast Wrap, Parliament resumes and environmental reforms are front and centre.
These reforms have been waiting for 5 years to be delivered. And in the meantime, we've seen our environment go backwards.
As the opposition pushes for the bill to be split, we'll have expert analysis to take you through what could come next. Then, century-old letters in a bottle found washed up on a WA beach with an extraordinary story inside.
I had a pair of surgical tweezers and I put them in the neck of the bottle and I twisted and twisted and twisted the piece of paper until it was like a cigarette size and I could pull it out through the neck of the bottle. And then when I unrolled it, I couldn't believe it.
That's all coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, the bells are ringing at Parliament House, and that can only mean one thing. It's a sitting week. Now, these weeks can deliver plenty of unexpected twists and turns, but today the focus is well and truly on the government's environmental law reforms. The Coalition has written to the government asking Labor to split a bill to overhaul environmental laws, but Environment Minister Murray Watt has rejected that proposal, saying there doesn't have to be a choice between productivity and the environment. Host Sally Sara kicked off her interview with Angie Bell, the Shadow Minister for the Environment, asking this.
Why have you asked the government to split this bill?
Well, we want to see some movement on this bill. We don't want to stand in the way of environmental reform. And so we've suggested to the government overnight how to improve their bill. So we want to see the bill split. So we can streamline approvals and we can improve environmental protections separately. And what we've seen from the government is a flat refusal immediately. And that's what we kind of expected, because it seems that it's their way or the highway.
You've said that you've only seen 50 to 70% of the draft legislation and industry is concerned by a lack of detail. Why not wait until the bill is introduced to Parliament?
Well, this was a way that we could get moving on this reform, which is what, of course, the minister has said that he wants as well. But you're right, we have only seen 50 to 70% of the detail of the draft legislation. And so we'll await the rest of it to see exactly how that fits in with the EPBC reforms. This is a huge bill, Sally, and your listeners may not understand exactly how enormous it is. But there are lots and lots of moving parts in this and recommendations from the Graham Samuel Review that outlined that there could be a balance between reform when it comes to protecting the environment and when it comes to certainty around jobs and industry, which is so important for the wealth of our nation.
Graham Samuel, who authored the review into environmental laws, says he's bitterly disappointed that the opposition leader is pushing back on Labor's reworked reforms. Are you concerned that you may have got it wrong here?
The minister has put in some of Graham Samuel's recommendations and others that he hasn't. For example, the premise of Graham Samuel's review was that there be a commission for the environment. And instead, what's happened is the minister has put out there an EPA, an Environmental Protection Agency, which was a promise by the Prime Minister at the election before the last one. And so there are some things that are straight out of the Samuel Review playbook, and there are elements in there of uncertainty around definitions of net gain, definitions of other areas in the legislation, and also very, very high penalties that were higher than Tanya Plibersek's positive laws.
So which aspects of the bill fall into the half that you think you'd be able to agree to and pass quickly?
Some of the things around regional planning certainly have merit, but we'll work through all of the detail when it lands, because we really only have some of the bill, and the minister has said he will introduce it this week into the parliament. So we'll have to quickly work through the rest of the detail, see how that fits into the EPBC Act as it is, and then move forward from there. Look, I'll continue speaking with the government on this, consulting on them on what their views are, to see if there's a way through with amendments. But at this point in time, this bill is not workable.
If you split the bill, do you risk Labor not wanting to work with you on the business aspect of the reforms, while giving Labor the opportunity to seek support from the Greens?
Well, I think there's a lot of complexity in this bill at the moment, and to split the bill would make it very clear for the outcomes. And the two outcomes that we want to see are faster approvals, streamlining those approvals, and environmental protections to make sure that we stop the degradation of our environment. And I think we think that could be achieved, but unfortunately the government has rejected that.
Senator Matt Canavan is presenting his review of net zero policies to the Nationals party room today. Can you see any scenario where the Nationals could support an environment policy that commits to net zero emissions by 2050?
Well, that is under the safeguard mechanism in terms of the committing of net zero by 2050. Look, the National Party is undertaking their own review process, as is the Liberal Party, and we'll continue to work through those processes.
Will the Coalition walk away from the Paris commitment?
That is a decision that will come as we go through this policy, as we land on what our energy policy will be. But Susan Lee has said that we need to play our part when it comes to reducing emissions.
Shadow Minister for the Environment, Angie Bell, speaking with Sally there. Well, as you might expect, during a sitting week, the ABC's Parliament House studios are bustling with politicians. And today we had Minister for Health and Ageing, Mark Butler, in the studio, where he was keen to outline the upcoming improvements to Medicare and reproductive health. From this Saturday, bulk billing incentives for doctors will be expanded, while a new pharmaceutical benefits scheme listing promises better access to contraceptive options. Sally also got in a question about the environmental laws and long-awaited gambling reform.
What are the changes for Australian women and their contraceptive options?
Well, it really built on changes we made earlier this year. We found that there had not been a new contraceptive pill added to the PBS for more than 30 years. It didn't mean there weren't new ones on the market, but hundreds of thousands of women were expected to pay top dollar because no one had bothered putting them on the PBS. We added three new pills, Yaz, Yasmin, Slinda, very widely used pills to the PBS earlier this year. This week we're adding NuvaRing, which is used by, we think, tens of thousands of women, that will cut the price by about two-thirds. And on Saturday as well, we'll slash the price for women who want to use long-acting contraceptives, IUDs or implants, who currently pay $300 or $400. They'll get that fully bulk billed from Saturday as well. So from the 1st of January, when we cut prices again for medicines, we're very confident that Australia's women will have access to all of the contraceptive choices, really, that they need for no more than $100 a year. And that will save hundreds of thousands of women many, many millions of dollars.
Surveys by ABC News and the Royal Australian College of GPs earlier this year indicated only a fraction of doctors believe they will be able to bulk bill more patients. What's your benchmark and timeframe to assess whether this policy will be operating on track?
Well, we said at the election that we thought this policy would reach a 90% bulk billing rate by the end of the decade. And that's a pretty conservative assessment. It will mean that doctors have some time and practice owners have some time to consider the financial impacts of the record investment that kicks in on Saturday. But as I said, we've obviously been in communication with general practices about this. Almost 1,000 practices as of Friday, 1,000 had said these are practices that currently charge a gap fee, that next week they'll move to a fully bulk billing model. And we're getting new practices every single day tell us that. So I know there was a bit of scepticism among some of the doctors' groups about this, but as I've been getting out over the last several weeks around the community, I've been going to practice after practice that have said they've crunched the numbers. They recognise that this is good for their patients, obviously, but it's also good for the individual doctors who work at the practice, and it's good for the practice itself.
On another matter, the government has indicated it will introduce draft laws to overhaul Australia's environmental protections to Parliament this week. Are you confident that you'll find support either from the opposition or the Greens, given their criticisms of various parts of the proposal in recent days?
Well, the Environment Minister, Murray Watt, has been working with both parties, the coalition parties and also the Greens Party. He's been meeting with their relevant spokespeople on this, had several meetings with both, and obviously meeting as well with industry, environmental stakeholders and state governments as well. He's been working very hard to get to a position where we can get these laws done before the end of the year. I mean, this has been hanging around for a long time now. Susan Lee, when she was opposition leader, commissioned and then received a report when she was the Environment Minister 5 years ago from Graham Samuel. And that's still the report that really forms the basis of the bill that we're going to bring to the Parliament. The BCA, the Business Council, is in Canberra today telling Parliament to get this done. Ken Henry told us earlier this year this was perhaps the most important productivity measure the Parliament could take in the economy. So it's time to get this done. We know there's going to be a debate. You know, we know that the Greens and the Coalition may put amendments to the Parliament, but really we've got to get this done this year.
Why reject the opposition's request to split the bill?
Well, this is a last minute, you know, frankly, stunt, we think. You know, there is not another group, that, as far as I'm aware, that Murray Watt has been engaging with who've said that they should split the bill. I mean, Graham Samuel, when he delivered that report to Susan Lee 5 years ago, made it clear that there are two objectives here. This has got to be good for the environment and it's got to be good for business and developers, not just sometimes the mining industry, which is seen as the sort of illustration of these, but we know new housing developments, renewable energy projects. The Business Council talks this morning about the need to get new health and aged care developments up as well. I mean, this is important for our whole economy and the whole of the bill needs to pass.
Do you regard problem gambling as a health issue?
I think pretty much everything is a health issue. You know, planning, you know, the way in which we structure our cities, the whole range of things on, you know, social media developments, gambling. Look, all of these have an impact on our mental health and often
portfolio?
On our physical impact. Well, if we took that view, everything would be under my portfolio.
But I'm not asking about
frankly,
everything.
Our physical health, our mental
health. This
particular
issue?
No, I don't think it should be. I think this is positioned quite rightly where it is in the communications portfolio, and I know the communications minister is working diligently on that.
Repeated polls have said that people want action, particularly on problem gambling and online gambling. If you reflect community values, why not do something about it?
Well, I think you'll find that our government has taken more action on problem gambling than any federal government before it. You know, we've taken
but
this
none
issue
on the Peter
very
Murphy review.
We've taken very, very seriously a range of recommendations, not just from that review, but from others as well. You will not find a federal government in our history that's done more on problem gambling than this one.
Minister for Health and Ageing, Mark Butler, speaking with Sally there. And to unpack those two interviews, Sally spoke with Radio National Breakfast's very own political correspondent, Melissa Clark.
It seems unlikely that the Coalition will support the government's bill.
Certainly the Coalition is pretty critical at this stage in the negotiations, but I do think it's worth noting the door hasn't entirely closed. And we have the same position from the Greens, highly critical of what they have seen so far, but nonetheless pointing to the fact the door is open to keep negotiating. We heard a fairly similar position in that regard from Sarah Hanson-Young on ABC News Breakfast a little earlier this morning.
I mean, this is the government's decision to take the climate trigger off the table while at the same time allowing coal and gas companies to have their projects fast-tracked. We think that is the wrong way.
So you can see there the Greens are saying this is the wrong way, we're not happy with how it is, but then in the next breath Sarah Hanson-Young went on to say, but look, our door is always open, and this is what we are. We're in a building of open doors this week that Murray Watt might have to find himself walking in and out of quite a bit.
Why has the Coalition suggested splitting this bill into two parts, Mel?
It's part of an effort by the Coalition to find a position it can land on this. The party room of the Liberal Party in particular has a range of views about what should and shouldn't be acceptable in this view from their point of view. Streamlined approvals for projects is something that they can all agree on, and if they could split the bill, you could pass that part and potentially not pass the other half of the environmental standards and other other elements that connect with that. Look, this idea of splitting the bills, it's an approach the Coalition tried when it was in government under the Abbott and Morrison governments and when Susan Lee was the Environment Minister. It failed at that point because Labor and the Greens didn't have any faith that the proposed second part, the upgrading the environmental protection part, would ever come. The situation's a little bit different for this Labor government because they have more options in the Senate. So it's quite possible that they could adopt this kind of approach and pass streamlining approvals with the Coalition and then separately pass the other elements, the new environmental standards, an independent EPA to monitor and enforce the laws with the Greens. Now, Murray Watt has ruled that out, but that's not to say that couldn't be something they do. It was a risky offering from Susan Lee, but one that gave them a position to stand on at this point in the negotiations.
Radio National Breakfast's political correspondent, Melissa Clark there. Turning overseas now, and Anthony Albanese is in Kuala Lumpur for this week's ASEAN meeting, marking his first trip to Malaysia as Prime Minister. Mr. Albanese is hot on the heels of US President Donald Trump, who touched down in Malaysia's capital yesterday to oversee the signing of a historic peace deal between Cambodia and Thailand. For more on this, Sally spoke with Dr. Petra Alderman, a researcher and manager of the Saw Swee Hock Southeast Asia Centre at the London School of Economics and Political Science.
How significant is President Donald Trump's attendance at this year's ASEAN summit?
I think in the grand scheme of things, this is really an exercise in political theatre. And I think a lot of that has been done for Trump himself rather than necessarily for the broader regional de-escalation of the conflict.
What exactly does the agreement between Thailand and Cambodia include?
If you look closely at the sort of 8 points that have been hashed out as part of this, what is often called as a joint declaration, it is basically a formal reaffirmation of the ceasefire that has been agreed on between the two countries earlier this year in August. So actually, if we look at it, it doesn't really necessarily go into any kind of commitment to a definitive resolution of the conflict, which has really been ongoing for many years and has deep historical roots. So the extent to which this will perhaps resolve the conflict fully, it remains actually questionable.
So given the optics of this peace deal signing, how does that tie into your initial point about the presence of Donald Trump?
Trump has been given a lot of platform, and he has really brandished this as, yet another peace deal that he was able and his administration was able to deliver. But then when you listen, especially perhaps to some of the remarks by the Thai Prime Minister, the sentiment there is slightly different. So, he has raised issues in terms of or has cautioned that the success of this declaration will very much depend on the implementation. And I think that is what really is the key here. When the cameras are off and there is maybe no more symbolic benefit for the US presidency, is this going to still feature on his radar compared to some of the other conflicts that the Trump administration is perhaps interested in resolving? This is comparably minor. And, how far the US is going to be interested in actually seeing this declaration implemented to the letter really remains to be seen.
Dr. Petra Alderman, a researcher and manager of the Saw Swee Hock Southeast Asia Centre at the London School of Economics and Political Science. For the final part of today's Breakfast Wrap, I'm going to take you back home for an extraordinary tale out of Western Australia. A bottle has been found on a beach in WA containing letters from two Australian soldiers who were on their way to the First World War. The diggers threw the sealed bottle overboard from a troop ship several days after departing Adelaide in August 1916. Well, 109 years later, the Brown family discovered the bottle at Wharton Beach near Esperance. Sally began this heartwarming story by speaking with Deb Brown before catching up with the families of the soldiers.
I had a pair of surgical tweezers and I put them in the neck of the bottle and I twisted and twisted and twisted the piece of paper until it was like a cigarette size and I could pull it out through the neck of the bottle. And then when I unrolled it, I couldn't believe it. And the fact that it was written in lead pencil, of course, has helped to save it, if nothing else, because it didn't run.
That's Deb Brown there. Well, the letters were written by Privates Malcolm Neville and William Harley, who were both reinforcements with the 48th Battalion of the AIF. While Private Harley survived the war, Private Neville was killed in action on the Western Front in April 1917. Anne Turner is the granddaughter of Private William Harley.
We are all absolutely stunned. So there are five grandchildren who are still alive. We're all in constant contact since it happened and we just can't believe it. It really does feel like a miracle. And we do very much feel like our grandfather has reached out to us from the grave. And he was a grandfather none of us ever met because he died not long after he came back from war, really. I mean, he had children and the oldest was 14, my auntie, when he passed away. And he passed away from throat cancer. And my granny nursed him the whole way through it. And theirs was a true love story. Granny had met William Kirk Harley a number of years before World War I. And the folklore that she always told us was she took one look at him and he's very handsome, very sweet face, and said, "That's the man I'm going to marry." And she didn't meet him again until well into World War I, after he'd been shot and went to recuperate in England. He then went back to war and was gassed. I think that gassing very much caused the throat cancer.
What do you think about his war service with what you know and also now having this connection of the letter?
Well, the letter was just amazing because it showed, I think, how he was in such high spirits 3 days after he left, and he writes this message to whoever finds it and hopes the finder is in good spirits like he is. And he hopes everything's going to go well and he'll be back in sunny South Australia soon. He obviously was really good at stopping that bottle up, putting it in the ocean, and it survived 109 years.
How do you reflect on the level of optimism and hope and adventure that seems to be between the lines in this letter?
I suppose by then they'd have some idea of the carnage because so many young men had been lost, but there was the absolute wanting to go to war and serve king and country. I think he would have been absolutely delighted to finally be off to go to war. And so I think that's where the optimism comes from. But, yeah, by then he must have actually had an idea that it was going to be brutal, but probably not. I reckon that brutality was so awful that until you got there, you wouldn't know just how bad it was going to be. I think it's really poignant and I feel very emotional when I see that the other young man had a mother to write to, and that message in the bottle was to his mother, whereas our grandfather long ago had lost his mother, so he just writes it to the finder of the bottle. And I think that's such a poignant difference between the two of them.
How proud do you feel of your grandfather and his service?
Well, enormously proud. I think we all really do feel he was so valiant, and I think he served with great dignity. Got wounded twice. I mean, what I love is he gets wounded, meets the love of his life, goes back to that hellhole of a battlefield, gets gassed, comes back and marries our grandmother. So I think that's, you know, it's a very romantic story, but it shows the depth of his wanting to fight, wanting to serve, his loyalty to the country. And I think we're all very, very proud of that.
Anne Turner, granddaughter of Private William Harley, speaking with Sally there. You can hear more interviews like that every morning from 5:30 a.m. on Radio National and find The Breakfast Wrap after that. Every interview was produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, while The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Michael Kermont. I'm Lexi Junowick. Catch you tomorrow.